The hardest thing about being a blues man, I suppose it really would be, is to leave the women alone. I've got a gal named Willie Mae. She lived way down the low, low lanes.
Yeah, on Solid on Blues and Roots, interview with Australian blues legend Dutch Tilders.
She lived way down the low, low lanes. Yeah, the way I got that woman, I declare stole her from another man.
Yeah, Dutch celebrating 50 years, professional blues player in the land of Oz.
All my life, baby, you know I had you wrong.
Yeah, this is an interview recorded 6th of April 2009 in Elwood, Australia. Life, Dutch Tilders talking to Sully Dodd.
Willie Mae, you know I had you wrong. That's all on account of I keep on breaking up a poor man's home.
Yeah, available to you exclusively on Sully.com.au. Sully Dog, Blues and Roots. Dutch Tilders, a lot of stories, a lot of history. Step back, doggers, and chill out on this one.
I get a thinking about Willie Mae. Cold chills creep somewhere down my spine. Sometimes I wished I were dead, but Willie Mae, I'm afraid of dying.
Welcome, Dutch Tilders, to Solly Dog Blues and Roots.
Willie Mae.
And great you can give us some time, one of the legends of Australian blues music.
Yeah, time I've got, Dennis, time I've got lots of time.
That's great. Well, thanks for stepping by and giving us some time. Well, it's... Let's go right back to where you started. You've been going 50 years, I think it's a celebration. There's a DVD out of 50 years of Dutch Tilders. Where did it all start for you, Dutch?
Well, I always wanted a guitar, you know, and every time I said to my father, I want a guitar, Dad, and he'd go out and buy me another harmonica. It was cheaper than a guitar. Anyhow, so anyway, I learned to play... a bit of piano when I was about, would have been, 7 or 8 years old. And then I went, I was about 12, 13, I went to this college where I wanted to keep on with the piano playing. And they said, no, we've got lots of kids here that are, it was one of those Catholic colleges. Actually, I was in a what do they call it, a juvenate. I was going to become one of them dear brothers, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why I wanted to be a brother. I had 4 brothers already. But anyway, they said, we want you, we need cello players. And so they set me down and played. I had to play this cello. I hated the damn thing. I mean, there was something. I loved the sound of cello today, but at that time, cello, it was too girlish for my liking.
Yeah.
You know? Why would I want to sit there with this thing in between my legs and bow it away? So when I came to Australia when I was 14, I got involved with... a black and white minstrel show where I was singing with that, and I played the harmonica in the Collingwood Town Hall.
Yeah.
I remember I got 17 and sixpence for the performance, but it cost me around about 2 and sixpence or 3 shillings or something for the taxi there and back. But it was something interesting to do.
Yeah.
And then I didn't know anything for a while, and I used to, you know, think, now I've got to get myself an instrument happening, you know. And I would have been, 18. I lived in Frankston, and I was taught on a friend's guitar 2-3 chords, and I said, I've got to get myself a guitar. And I saw Brashies, they had a guitar there, and it cost £28. And I'm looking at it and saying, nah, I can't afford £28. I mean, that was 2 weeks' wages, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was, at that time, I was handing most of my money over to my family.
Yeah.
You know, so I just couldn't afford to buy it. But I had a spare £5 and a fella called Rabbit Welsh. Rabbit, he had this Ibanez. It looked like it had been kicked around like a football for a while, but it was okay. It worked.
Yeah.
And he sold it to me for £5. I reckon he was laughing all the way back home with that £5 in his hand, because I'm sure he robbed me. But anyway, and I started picking out a few chords, and of course with my piano playing time, I knew what chords were all about.
Yeah.
And so I worked out exactly where to put fingers and how to form different chords. And I actually used to sit down and write down the diagram of the guitar neck and put the dots in where the fingers are supposed to go, like you see like the ukulele or guitar chords on over a piece of written music, you know. Yes. With the words underneath and all that, you know.
Yeah.
Like that. And anyway, I kept working on that, and I started playing at parties, you know. In those days, people enjoyed somebody who could actually play a guitar, and whether it was good, bad, or indifferent, didn't matter, as long as somebody could strum the damn thing and sing a song, you know.
And were you singing country then, or blues?
I was into blues. I was always into blues, but yeah. The thing is that there's a lot of other songs I knew. There was, you know, there was folk songs. There was a folk era was happening, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I could sing stupid stuff like, oh, Mary, don't you weep for me. You know, that sort of thing. And songs like the fox went out one chilly night and he prayed for the moon to give him light, and that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah,
you could
yeah.
do all that. Actually, I wound up doing that for the children later. But I was making up the blues, you know, because that was what the blues is about. You see, you sing the line, and you play the guitar line, and you sing the same line again while you're thinking of the third line, the
yeah.
last line, the punchline. You see,
yeah.
And that's why 12-bar blues. It didn't happen anywhere else in the world. It only happened in America. That was one of those things that occurred there. Unique. And so next thing, I'm sitting around parties, making up songs as I go along, being a little bit bawdy, of course. That was the thing, you know, ribald.
Yeah.
Ribald, bawdy, and blasphemous.
Yeah, yeah.
And a fellow, the name of Bill Nissen, he opened up a coffee lounge in Frankston. It was called the Cat's Whiskers. And he said, why don't you come over on a Friday and Saturday night and play? Because I was, you know, I had a day job. I was a tool setter, you know.
Yeah.
And I was starting to make good money by then. So I really didn't need the extra money. And he said, I'll pay you £3. I said, no, yeah, all right, okay. And eventually, it was too much for him. He said, "I'll give you a nice T-bone steak." Was it? I didn't care, you know. And a fellow called Alex Hitspeed. He put on a program in this. I'm going back now. This is 1959. You know, like, and I went to Sydney first. Yeah, and I met Shane Dockham, and I played. He's a harmonica player. He was the first blues harmonica player I heard, except for, hang on a minute, I must remember that now. There was Graham Squance who played blues, and he had a harmonica player by the name of Ken White. Yeah, so now Shane Dockham wasn't the first, he was the second blues harmonica player I heard. And we teamed up and started doing the coffee lounge scene in Sydney.
Yeah.
And this went all the way through up to 1963. And eventually I came back to Melbourne. The coffee lounge scene was over and done with, and I didn't do much at all. Went here, there, a few other little places. There was the places like, I think, the Fourth Wall. That was in 1964. And the Riata. I think it was the Riata, or was it Little Riata? I get them two mixed up. But and then eventually I sort of didn't do much at all for a while, and then came along the
yeah, listening to Dutch Tilders. Talking to Sully Dog, pretty good interview about his starting out in the Australian blues scene in the 50s, right up until now, 2009. Let's hear a track from The Blues Had a Baby with Kevin Borish. This one, Don't Take Long.
The Union Youth Movement thing, they had folk music in with the Union Youth Movement, and I wound up playing at what the hell was that place? That place in the city where the Union Hall is, where somebody anyhow I was doing that one, and I sort of kept, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, just kept right on doing it. Then in 70, I met a man called Alex Headspeed, and he said, "I'd like to be your manager and get you work, you know." And I said, "Oh, okay, you know." And it wasn't really all that important to me because I was making good money as a tool sitter.
Yeah.
You know. That first gig he got me was at the George in Fitzroy Street.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be damned. It's down in the Dragon Room. It was a bit of a zoo, you know.
Yeah.
And they had these...
Still is.
Well, they had these... They're all 1956ers, you know. They had the Tony Curtis curl and the duck ass back of the hair and on sideburns and... And the women had thighs on them as thick as my chest, with tattoos saying "This way, sport," arrows pointing upwards. they had a regular in-house band there, and the guy said, "Did you bring any charts?" And I said, "Charts? I'm not going anywhere. I don't need no charts. I'm not at sea." He said, "You're not music charts." And I said, "Nah, I don't even read music. I don't need it. I just do everything as it comes off the cuff." And he said, "Well, if we're going to back you, we're going to need some charts." And I said, "No, you don't need to back me. I'm going to do it by myself." And he said, "What sort of music do you?" And I said, I sing the blues." And he said, He said, we had a lady here the other week, and she was doing stuff from Fiddler on the Roof, and she had the chance, and we did this show, and they picked her up and threw her out." We had a fella here, he was doing Frank Sinatra type songs, and they threw a jug of beer on him and then picked him up and threw him out. And I gone, yeah, right, this is a great gig, thank you, Alex. Anyhow, I said, well, I'll brave it, but I'll do it here by myself, and just don't worry about it, you know. So he said, okay, it's your life. So I got up there and I thought, now I ain't going to be able to sing a no nice, real neat little blues here, you know. So I did everything I knew that was up tempo, everything I knew that was as bawdy as all hell. As a matter of fact, one of the songs, one of those big girls there, she pointed at me and she waved a finger at me and said, you are rude! And I was only supposed to do a 40-minute guest set, you know. I was there for an hour. I was afraid to get off. The band eventually enjoyed me playing some rock and roll type stuff, and then I was just absolute hit in the place, you know.
Fantastic.
And I started off very frightening, though.
Yeah. So that was in the George.
That was in George, yeah.
Yeah, in St Kilda. When did you? So after that, what happened then, Dutch? Just when you started doing recording? When did you start recording?
Well, Alex Headspeeth, he got me on to, would have been 1971, I think, he got me on to New Faces, and I won my heat, and then, but before that, that's right, before I went to New Faces, yeah. Before that, I played in a thing called Screening the Blues that Alex Headspeeth put up at Margaret Road Night, the Adderley Smith Blues Band, with Joe Camilleri up front at that time because Broderick Smith was in the Army.
Yeah.
A couple of other bands, myself doing a solo thing, and he recorded it from backstage. Not a very good recording, but... Ron Tudor heard an awful lot of applause, so he figured, okay, he was setting up a new record label with Brian Cadd, Bootleg, which was an unfortunate name at the time, because at that time, Bootleg records were getting about all over the place, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and anyhow, I got a contract through that. A lot of people thought that I actually got that contract because of the I won it on the New Faces program with Frank Wilson was the host of that at that time, and no, it wasn't that. I already had that.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And then I did that New Faces thing. Then I wound up doing a recording in 1972, which came out in 1973, self-titled album. And the Bootleg family was had developed, and we went start touring. Now, before all that, I was doing lunchtime concerts at all the different universities and campuses. About in those days, students had a bit more. Money to spend on entertainment. You know, they had activities offices and all that sort of stuff. And
that's
and,
right. Yeah.
You're probably there.
I was there.
Yeah. Anyway, not like today. You know, today it's ever so rigid. They don't have one campus anymore. You go to five different campuses to do five different subjects or something.
That's right. Yeah.
And back in those days, if you went to Melbourne University, you did your five subjects right there at Melbourne University. That's what you did.
Yeah.
And of course, they had lunchtime concerts and all that sort of stuff, and sometimes evening things, you know. And I'd have to do a lunchtime concert, and of course, I've got a day job. I'm setting tools. I used to say to my foreman, "I'm taking a sickie tomorrow." And he'd say, where are you playing? And that was good because, I mean, they needed me. You know, in those days, skilled people were needed. There was no unemployment.
Yeah.
In fact, there was spaces all over the place for people to take over a job.
Yeah.
So, and they paid you well over union rates. And you could actually, if I didn't like the look of the foreman, I'd tell him to go and stuff it where the monkey stuffed his nuts, and I go next door and get myself another job. You know,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
the way it was.
Yeah,
those days are gone.
Yeah, listening to Dutch Tilders. Interview with Solly Dog on Solly Dog Blues and Roots. Let's hear a track Dutch did on a directed cut disc. We're going to hear about that in a minute.
Way been so long.
The old standard Carina Carina.
Carina Carina. Where you been so long? Ain't had no love since Carina been gone. I love Carina. Tell the world you do. I love Carina. Tell the world I do. And I hope and pray she's gonna come to love me too. Carina, Carina, way across the sea. Carina, Carina, way across the sea. Ain't done no good since Carina left me. Won't you come back home? Carina, Carina, won't you come back home? If you do, baby, ain't gonna do you no wrong. Do you want my silver? Do you want my gold? Do you want my silver? Honey, do you want my gold? If you want gold, baby, don't wait till the Dutchman gets too old.
This was going on for a while now. I was doing all that sort of stuff. Then so we had this bootleg family tour, and I had to give notice. And from there on in, I was now a full-time professional musician.
So if that was the early 70s?
That was 1973.
73.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I was a professional long before that. But,
yeah, yeah.
But only a part-time.
Full-time.
Now all of a sudden, full-time. Don't have a day job anymore, you know. Yeah, that's when she did the fan.
How did you find that? What happened then?
Oh, we traveled all over the damn place. I didn't like it much. I didn't like this troop running, you know. I couldn't get along with everybody. And, but, you know, we did a national tour. I think we did two of them. And then after a while, I quit all that. And I got new management and just did my own solo thing. And
I've
been doing it ever since.
Yeah, and doing it very well, too, and still pulling those crowds. Dutch, you're obviously Dutch, we know that. That's why they call you Dutch.
No. They call me Dutch because I'm Chinese.
That's right. But what got you to why the blues?
I don't know. I really can't tell. I heard it when I was about 13 years old. And once I heard it, I was hooked. I don't know. I couldn't understand a word it was singing about. I mean, I could understand English, but hang on a minute. I'm listening to some stuff here that just wasn't English, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the Am Bam Boys, you know, like for a starter, you know, they couldn't even say Alabama or Mississippi. There's Mississippi and Am Bam, you know? and everything else that goes with that, you know. I had no idea what it meant, but I liked the sound of it. It was a different kind of jazz to me, you know, because I was into jazz, but it was a different kind of jazz. I got hooked on it. The more I listened to it, the more I understood. There's a hell of a lot of songs about that. A lot of people, they sing them today. I hear them sing them today, and they don't understand what it means.
Yeah.
But they're singing them, you know. There was, for instance, the Rolling Stones did an absolute beautiful, as far as I can see, complete faux pas. That was that song, I'm a Man. I'm spelled M-A-N. What they don't understand is that was a protest song written by Muddy Waters, and it had to do with the garbage collectors. The city garbage collectors were all black people, and they were being called boy because they were black. And they protested in the streets saying, I'm a man, I'm spelled M-A-N. That was what that was about.
Yeah.
Because the Rolling Stones thought it was all about being a sexy person, you know, like a male, you know, thing, you know. But, knock me out.
Well, it works both ways. So, now, you started writing your own material, and you've written a lot of stuff. when did you start that?
Well, I started writing right from the beginning because I was making them up because I didn't know too many songs, so I was making them up.
Yeah.
You know, and I was making them up about people I knew.
Yeah.
You know, a party event, for instance. You know, I used to sit in the Cat's Whiskers, and the people, we'd been to a party and all got over drunk and some behaviors went on and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
The next thing you know, they found out I was singing about them. Just making it up, you know.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Which you can do, because that was the line, you see.
Yeah.
I read a book, didn't read the book, I read part of a book, and it belonged to my first wife's great uncle, Ben Barker, and he said he's an old Yorkshireman, and when I visited his house at Yarra Junction, when I first met him, he said, I believe you're interested in the music of the Darkies. That's the way he spoke.
Hmm.
I said, yeah, I like the blues, you know. And he said, you might be interested in this. And he went to his huge shelf, which is just laden with books. He was a piano player himself and an artist. And he pulled this damn book out, and it had no cover on it. And the first pages were missing, like, you know, the pages that says publisher, printing, copyright, all that, you know, those first pages. And in fact, I think the title was missing.
Yeah.
Anyway, he said, this is about Negro spirituals, he tells me.
Yeah.
I said, oh, okay. So I'm not interested in Negro spirituals. I'm not. I can't sing God songs. I don't believe in God, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's... Mind you, I don't believe there... I don't necessarily know there is one, but that... I can't sing God songs, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm having a look through this, and it appears to be written by a man who traveled from plantation to plantation, being a plantation owner himself. Figured that one out, and he collected what there was then called Negro spirituals. He likened it with European sacred songs. And how they got changed, and how they actually changed from one plantation to another.
Yeah.
They had quite a number of notations of different songs. They say, for instance, Just a Closer Walk with Thee, he had that written down. But I looked at that because I can read, you know. And it wasn't exactly the same as the one that I know now. But then next thing you know, he has another version of it, and that wasn't exactly the same either. There was a similarity. And then some of the lyrics were different as well. He wrote all that down. It was all in this book. So now, yeah, all very interesting, very interesting. Right. And he's traveling from plantation to plantation. And then eventually, I come to a part. I'm skipping through all this, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I come to this part, and it's all about, this is a revelation to me. These freemen. That meant Negroes who were enslaved. And they worked on the docks and the levees and the riverboats. And they played banjos.
Yeah.
And he said they sang a blasphemous, ribald and bawdy type of song. And then he explains how he said it's about their women folk, about their work, and about their friends, and about their sexual prowess. He said, "Oh yeah, right. That sounds like the blues to me." Then he goes on and he explains. They sing the line. They make it up. They sing the line. Answer it with the banjo, in African traditional way of answering.
Yeah.
Right. And sing the same line again, while making up the last line, which is the punchline.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm going, he's talking about the blues.
Yeah.
You know. And there's so many people that always they said, "Oh, the blues came from the slaves." No, it came from the time of the slaves. But it didn't come from the slaves. It came from freemen.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't realize that not every black man in the States was a slave.
Yeah.
And a lot of people want to argue that. I got another theory, too, on that one. As a matter of fact, there was a very, very rich black class in New Orleans and places like that that probably traded in slavery, because slavery is not a white man's disease, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody uses slavery.
Yeah.
You know. And of course, you understand that in Africa, it was one tribe raiding another tribe for slavery.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was, it's not like the white man is the only one guilty of slavery, you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah, we know this. I mean, we go back in the Bible, you'll find that Abraham had a slave.
Yeah.
Well, somebody had to do something for him on the Sabbath, you know.
Yeah.
Called the rising sun, and it's been the ruin of many poor women and mine. She was one. Had her listen to what her mother said, she'd have been at home today. But being so young and foolish, oh Lord, she did a rambler, she did a rambler, lead her astray. She did, oh yes, she did. Tell my baby sister, don't do like she's done, like she's done. Please shut that house in New Orleans. They want to come, the rising sun. Yeah, and that's when I thought, you know, how old is this music? You know, I mean, this is before the American Civil War.
Yeah.
Which started in 1864, wasn't it, something like that? Something like, or was it finished in 1864? Yeah. It was something.
My dates aren't that good.
Somewhere about there. So how old is this music, you know? And Papa Charlie Jackson was probably one of the last ones to come out of the 19th century into the 20th century, playing the banjo.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a blues singer, but he played the banjo. What happened around about from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, I believe that the cheap instrument became the mail order guitar.
Yeah.
You see?
Plywood job.
And that's when the guitar became the instrument in the blues, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think I read somewhere Ry Cooder said his favorite guitar was an old mail order plywood thing, but you played with Ry Cooder at one stage, didn't you?
No, I've never played with Ly. No,
I thought
no.
You did.
No, I've never met him.
Never met him?
No, I don't know him from Adam.
Someone told me a lie.
Yes, I probably would know him from Adam because Adam would be stinking by now.
Someone's told me a lie then. It could have been you.
That wasn't me. It would be some other good looking mother for you. It wasn't me.
So tell me, Dutch, you only play guitar? You only stuck with the guitar after that?
Yeah, yeah. I like to have a bash on the piano so every now and then.
Yeah.
But I'm not much good at it.
Yeah.
My technique is so bad that I wind up with a sore wrist after about 2 minutes.
Right. Yeah. And in terms of all those influences, is anybody that was an influence on you early days?
Well, I was influenced by Bibble Brunzi, Latin Hopkins, Lemon Jefferson, and Ray Charles, inadvertently. I didn't never realize for a while. I used to love Ray Charles, but I never thought in terms of doing music like he did, you know?
Yeah.
But somehow it crept in there, regardless, you know. I love Ray Charles.
He was
just absolutely amazing, amazing blues singer. And he could get hold of even songs out of Oklahoma and give him a bluesy feel.
Yeah.
You know, he was very, very, he was a genius, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
They didn't call him the blind genius for nothing.
Yeah.
You know. But other people, T-Bone Walker, I love T-Bone Walker. I love the way he could warble so nicely, you know. And Muddy Waters, another one, you know, how to get that roll sound, you know.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And Johnny Hooker, and there was so many, and you know, like for me, in the 1960s, when other people used to say they liked the blues, they said, well, I've got John Mayall records, and I've got Alex Corner records, and I've gone, yeah, come on, listen to my collection here. And they've gone, ooh, that's the blues.
Yeah. That's right. Now, you play fingerstyle blues.
Yeah. I always did. I could never hold a flat pick in my hand.
Yeah.
The bloody thing goes down to holding the guitar.
Now, everybody who's a picker, you know, has to learn that technique.
That was difficult.
Is it self-taught with you, Dutch?
There's nobody around to show me.
So how did you get there?
I don't know. I heard it on record, you see, and I figured, oh, no, that's how it's supposed to be done, fingers. And I started off by using my thumb, and then going boom-ding, right thing. You know, like hit the bass note and then the high note with the finger alternatively.
Yeah.
And I just kept doing that until I could get that rhythm happening. And then eventually, I'd add another finger, you see?
Yeah.
Then I got the idea of using those two fingers, my first and middle finger, in any which way, any different pattern, rhythm pattern, while keeping my thumb moving.
Yeah.
You know, but it's one of those things, it's like people how they learn to do that, what do they call that breathing that they do with trumpets and didgeridoos,
circular
breathing, breathe in through your nostrils while you're blowing out what you got in your mouth, you know. That's all very nice. You try it. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
But I'm sure what happens is that once you get it, if you persist, once you get it, it becomes easy. It becomes natural.
Yeah.
And I found the same thing with that thumb and the finger picking thing, that eventually it became, you know, just a normal way to play it. As a matter of fact, I can't play any other way.
Yeah.
You know? And I taught it to a fella once. We sat up till about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning with a bottle of scotch. And I showed him how it was done. And he just sort of like, he was fumbling about. And eventually he said, yeah, I think I got it. And it went natural.
Yeah.
And we were both drunk. I hope he remembered the next day. actually he did, but...
Now, Dutch, you used to play with the Windsor Hotel, the Blues Club. You had a lot of young proteges there, like Jeff Atchison. A lot of people that you've brought on in the blues in Australia. What's your memories of all that stuff?
Yeah, we listened to Dutch Tilders talking to Sully Dog on Sully Dog Blues and Roots about his 50 years in the Australian blues scene, and it's his... 68th birthday in 2009. Dutch Tilders, let's hear a track before we go on and talk about the Blues Club, which was an institution. This track, Big Bill Bronzy Number.
Hey, hey, baby, hey. Hey, hey, baby, hey. I love you, dog, but I'm damned if I'll be your dog. Hey, 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 baby, hey. Hey, 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 baby, hey. When I got my arms around you, baby, all I can say is, hey, babe. Hey, babe, you lost your good thing now. Hey, babe, you lost your good thing now. Well, now you thought you had me fooled, but I found you out somehow. Hey, baby, hate your dirty ways. Hey, baby, hate your dirty ways. When I feel like leaving, it's your dirty way to make me stay. Hey, 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 baby, hey. Hey, 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 baby, hey. Hey, babe, hey, hey, baby, hey. Hey, baby, then I'm gonna call on you one more time. Hey, baby, I'm gonna call on you one more time. Hey, baby, you're making me lose my mind. Hey, 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 baby, hey. Hey, 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 baby, hey. Hey, baby, hey, hey, baby, hey. Well, I had this jam session happen at the Windsor Castle in Windsor Parade, you know.
It was on Monday nights, wasn't it?
On a Monday night. It ran for about 10 years.
That's right.
And, what we was doing, people used to come around and jam with me, and some of them would do things on their own and stuff like that. And we had, at one stage, enough musicians about to actually form my own band, and that's how the Blues Club was born.
Yeah.
That was the name of that band. And Martin Cooper, who plays with me again now, he left to pursue other things, and it was Winston Galea, the drummer, who talked Jeff Atchison into disbanding his band. He had a band called Jazz Blues.
Yeah.
He said, because he'd come around on the Monday night jams, and he fitted in perfectly.
Mm.
I was never going to ask him. Of course, he's a hell of a good guitar player, and I thought, well, maybe he might not be interested anyway. I do remember saying, you ought to join us, because your own band is not making any money. It's not going anywhere, and which it wasn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, Winston Galea convinced him. He said, you better, get rid of your band. And And so Jeff joined us, and then we toured all throughout Australia for a number of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the finest bands I've had forever that I can remember. I had a band back in '80 with Mick Elliott and Dave Murray and Charlie Ellell on drums and my wife on flute Peter Fraser on sax. Peter Fraser left. A fella called Ian Wyatt joined. My wife sacked herself, which was good because you know,
saved you a lot of trouble.
She did that PMT thing, and we were about to go on stages, and she's in the band room crying her eyes out, and mascara running all over the place, and what can I say? I mean, I could scream at her and say, "Get your crap together and get on stage, woman." And that'd be divorce, wouldn't it? So the bass player used to do it. Anyway, she decided she had enough of all this tripping about the country and she sacked herself, which is good.
So you had that band, Blues Club. Is that the only band you've had, or have you had a few?
Well, that's the one I was telling you, the one I was telling you before, back in 1980. That was the R&B 6, which became just the Dutch Little's Blues Band.
Yeah.
The first time I actually got a band together was with Dave Minton on the piano, a fella called Mario somebody who was playing drums, and Colin Graham on the bass. And the first gig we got was at the Titan Hotel in Mornington. It's on the highway. I think it's called the Titan. And it was in back in those days, ladies' lounges. We had ladies' lounges, you know.
Yeah.
And generally, you were supposed to wear a jacket and tie in a ladies' lounge, at least a jacket. Or no jacket, at least wear a tie. And you had to be accompanied, you had to be with women to be there. You couldn't just, walk into a ladies' lounge. This is 1964, maybe, maybe 4 or 5. And we got this gig there, and they had this piano there that was sort of like not only a quarter tone down, which didn't really matter because we could all tune to that, but it wasn't in tune with itself.
So
it was a real honky-tonk type thing, and Dave Minton had played that piano, and we did all these songs. So I did a couple of like That's All Right Mamas and Hound Dog. Of course, that's basically, if you didn't do that, they figured you couldn't play music, but to get to the men's toilet, we were sort of like by this sliding, big window with a sliding door. And the men's toilet was through there. We had these guys in overalls, right, with grease paint on, grease and paint and stuff on them, coming through the band in order to go to the toilet and staggering into things And I said, "Yeah, well, interesting stuff. This we all got £4 each for this, which that was good money." Because we're talking about when people were making £18 a week, So it wasn't not too bad. Anyway, the manageress or hostess or publican, I don't know who she was, but she said, "Well, we'll see you next Friday," and I said, "I don't think so." That band lasted one gig. I wasn't going to do that stuff. I was too busy working anyway, And all of us in the band, we all had day jobs, So, no, it wasn't exactly...
Wasn't going to happen.
No, it wasn't going to happen.
But Terry Dutch, you played all over the place in Australia. Have you done much overseas?
New Zealand only.
New Zealand only?
And Tasmania.
And Tasmania.
Don't forget Tasmania.
That's overseas. And so you've really stuck with Australia. Why was that?
Oh, I like Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, people say, when you go to the United States, what the hell do I want to go there for? I saw it on television.
Yeah. So it's just been a strange thing. And what's the people's, you know, you're playing in front of people all the time. What's the reaction to the blues? Has it changed over the years?
No, it's pretty much the same. People who love it, you know, and that's what happens.
Yeah.
I think the audience is, I think I helped doing it, by the way. I think I helped do that. The audience has got larger.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's more people understand the blues today than they did when I first started. In fact, when I first started, they thought the blues was a football team.
Yeah. It still is. Listening to a track, Dutch Tilders and Kevin Borish, a director disc thing from the early 70s, just called The Blues Had a Baby. This track, Dutch Tilders' track, Bad Books. If you had to say what some of the really great memories of playing, what would they be?
Well, it was there was the relationship I had with Bryony McGee when we started touring together around Australia. And we had a lot of fun, Bryony and I. We used to sit around after the gig, you know, like you think, all right, we put all this energy out and performing and stuff like that. You think, you know, you'd want to sort of lay your head down.
Yeah.
And, no, we used to sit up till 4 o'clock in the morning just with guitars on our laps. Him with a bottle of scotch, me with a dozen long necks of beer. And just play songs, you know, and swap songs and just yarn. And it was great fun. He was a great man. I was never a great fan of his guitar playing or even his singing, but his lyrics were the ones, because I'm into lyrics. Lyrics is the blues. The guitar playing is only jazz, you know. I was very sad when he died. It was very, very sad. Yeah, he turned out to become a very good friend of mine.
That's great. Mm. So in terms of lyrics, what's a really good blues lyric that's in your head?
Oh, just straight out lines, like it wasn't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all, and you know, and then from there on you make the rest of the nonsense, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Ronnie came up with it. The blues had a baby, and they call it rock and roll.
Yeah,
I mean, wow, you know, and he was right.
He was right.
Yeah, the blues had a baby. They call it rock and roll.
Yeah,
mind you, you know, like I suppose. A lot of that stuff that they called rock and roll was the blues in the first place.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right.
Hmm.
That's right. What's the hardest thing about being a blues man?
Living up to your reputation.
Believe in your own propaganda.
Yeah.
Well, Dutch, that's not an answer. Give us one.
Oh, the hardest thing about being a musician, full stop, is travel. And trying to keep your books together. And of course, you've got to worry about rip-offs. You've got to worry about, travel. accidents happen.
Yeah.
Well, you can see what happened to Max Barrett, for instance, you know.
Yeah.
The hardest thing about being a blues man, I suppose it really would be, is to leave the women alone.
this is a good line. You're going to have a lot of 18-year-olds taking
you
it
just
up,
get huh? yourself into trouble, and more yeah. trouble, and you go, you know, that's probably the hardest thing, is to leave the women alone.
Yeah.
It's not so hard now that I'm a lot older.
Yeah. There's someone else about in their early 20s told me it was the same problem. Or is it a good problem to have?
Well, women troubles is the best kind of trouble you can have, as far as I can see. Because, I mean, if you got no women troubles, you must be, you're not alive.
You can't live with it, you can't live without it. That's
what, you that's, can't use their bones for soup.
That's right. Now, you've got a DVD out of 50 Years, Just Run Round, Volume 1. Is there going to be another volume of that one?
Oh, yeah, we got another one in the pipeline. I don't know what Tom Sawyer put the producer of this thing has got in mind, and what my manager has got in mind. I don't really care. I just let him do it, you know.
Yeah.
Just get it out. As a matter of fact, I looked at that and I thought, just me again.
Yeah. Now, Terry, I want to go back. Some stuff I had a vinyl which was ruined in the humidity of North Queensland, but you did some direct disc recordings way back in the, mid-late 70s?
The late 70s.
Which were pretty audiophile things.
79 and 80.
Yeah.
I did one direct, I did that with Peter Howell on the bass, Jimmy Conway on harmonica, and Bob Birtles on saxophones.
Yeah.
And that was our first attempt at direct-to-disc, and it was probably the first commercial direct-to-disc with unlimited, supplies. Like a lot of direct-to-discs, they said, we can only put out 40,000.
That's right.
And Les Simmons, who was Eureka Record boss at the time, he said, "That's bulldust. You can put out as many as your damn well please, and they'll still all be just as same, you know." Which he did, and he never did give me the gold record for that, but we sold enough to warrant the gold record thing.
Yeah.
But then after the year later, and we got together with Kevin Burridge. And we did that Blues Had a Baby, and they called it Rock and Roll album.
Yeah.
That was direct-to-disc.
Yeah.
And the only problem with that one was that we couldn't get enough airplay with it. Of course, there were too many big gaps between tracks, you know. Because by that time, record spinners on radios were doing three or four tracks in a row.
Yeah.
Before they get into the commercial or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they back announce and all that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them, we had something like as many as 10 seconds break between tracks.
Yeah.
Because Kevin had picked up the wrong guitar for that particular number, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's all set out and it's got to be cut in one go, you see.
Yeah.
You can't stop.
Yeah.
You know. So anyway, 10 seconds of dead air. No way.
So those things
were another $1 million lost.
Yeah. Those things recorded, when you direct a disc in those days, you just set up the studio and recorded it straight through.
Well, yeah, that's the only way.
Cut the disc.
It was exactly the same they used to do 78s before tape recorders and wire recorders. Wire recorders and tape recorders
were
invented, you see. And they used to do a three-minute song is what they put on a 78, 3 or 4 minutes, was the best they could cut.
Yeah.
You know, and they do several takes of it and take the best take.
Yeah.
You see. Then, of course, the tape recording became the big deal. And so, therefore, you could actually stop it any way you wanted to and cut in and that sort of stuff, you know. So, and then the tape would go to be played back to the lathe to cut the damn thing.
Yeah.
But here, it was Sheffield Laboratories in the States that decided to do albums, direct to disc, because then you didn't have the tape hiss. You didn't have the Dolby system, which actually took some of the tops out of things.
Yeah.
You know, it got rid of the hiss, but...
yeah.
Yeah. And so you had real sound. Harry James, I think, did one in a church as well. You know, he had a whole bunch of young musicians with him, and him and his trumpet player, and he was 70 years old, and he still had the great lip. Yeah, he did one, and then somebody else did one. And then we decided to do it here. And it was a band in Sydney... Oh, was it Galapagos Duck or somebody like that? They did one, but they only did a limited edition thing again. And we decided, okay, we can do this and sell 40, 50,000.
Yeah.
We can do that.
Yeah.
You know? And we did.
Let's hear a cut off that Blues Had a Baby live direct cut disc under the lathe. Nearly 70s, Dutch Childers, Kevin Borish.
They call me Moonlight. I do my best work in the dark. In the dark. Well, when I come sneaking around your house, please don't let your bulldog bark. Let me be your little dog. Until you big dog come. Let me be your little dog. Until you big dog come. When your big dog gets there,
but what happens is if you're going to put about doing a good deep cut, you're going to put about 15, 16 minutes aside.
Yeah.
You know, anything over 20 minutes is the cut is too shallow, you know.
Yeah.
So you start off with you got this list of songs you're going to do one after the other, one after the other, whatever. Now you get to around about 14 minutes, right? The last tune is coming up, and you stop the last bit of the one you did previously, and you got to start all over again because you know, you don't want no stuff ups, you know.
So that's a collector's item.
Sometimes it was the actual the lathe operator that could stuff up because he put too much single in. We did that with the Kevin Burridge thing. Mike Deep played a really nice big heavy bass note, and the lathe just went right across everything.
Well, that's a collector's item now. That thing, a direct to disc in Australia, with Dutch Tilders on blues. Tell me, your guitars, are you fussy about your guitars?
Oh, I'm not. They've got to be easy to play, because I'm an old, lazy old man, you know.
Yeah.
As long as they're easy to play, they're fine. I'm using the Gibson at the moment, but for a long time, for about 30 years, I used a Noise guitar made by Ian Noise in Ballarat.
Yeah.
Lovely guitar, but I had to put her away because she's drying out, starting to crack, and... So I wound up with a Gibson J185, the courtesy of Gallons. Music stores, and I got it for a very, very good deal, an extremely good deal. Otherwise, I'd never be able to afford it, you know.
Yeah.
And she does. She does really nice by me. I feel beautiful with her. Yeah. She's got a nice tone. She's a big bodied, sits well on my lap. The neck feels just right, and that's basically all I really want from a guitar. You know?
Yeah. So you're not sort of like picky, crazy instrument.
I'm going deaf anyway, so I can't tell.
Some people
they sound like. You know.
Well, the proper blues man doesn't matter if it can be a plywood box.
You consider it. I mean, people like Blind Lemon and Jefferson way back, and they had those. All of those people, they had those mail order guitars, and they weren't exactly, you know, of classical style. You know,
no,
generally made out of plywood, so they could, you know, throw them into a railway wagon and jump in after it. You know,
that's right. Well, if it doesn't cost too much, you don't care if you lose it, I suppose. Which is the other thing. So you've been travelling around playing. You're going to be doing a lot of sort of work with the 50-year DVD and other stuff in Australia.
Well, I've been to West Australia since that came out, and South Australia. Yeah, and I'll be going to Queensland in a while, and Tasmania, and hopefully towards the end of the year, I might be back in New Zealand for a little while. Yeah,
right. And are you mainly solo now, or are you still with a band?
I do both. If the venue can afford it, I use a band. The venue can't afford it, then. They don't get a band. They just get me.
And tell me, of all the blues things that's happening now, who you got your eye on? You know, the young blues players.
Well, I'm planning to. We are planning. It was actually a Lloyd Spiegel's idea. Young blues player.
Yeah.
Decided that Phil Manning, Lloyd, and myself, we should do a CD tribute to Brownie McGee. And I think, great idea, actually. We do three, four songs each, but all Brownie McGee tunes, you know.
Yeah.
Except for one that I wrote. But, well, because I knew the man, I had a right to write it.
Exactly. Tell me about the black shirt. Stick it there.
Yeah, 1950s, black shirts. Black, it was, I'd saved up half a kit. I think it was about 17 shillings for this shirt or something like that.
Yeah,
it was only 3 shillings of a pound, for crying out loud, and I was working at 18 pounds a week. Actually, I was lucky. Most kids at my age were getting only about 13, 14 pounds a week.
Yeah.
In those days, they used to pay you by the age, you know. You didn't get a full wage until you were 21.
Yeah.
But if you're good at something, they always give you more, you see. So, as a matter of fact, I was making about the same, close to the same amount of money my father, as a fully-fledged furniture upholsterer,
is that right?
Was making, which was good for the family. And we just, you know, all my money went into the family thing. And I used to have an allowance of that. And then I saved up and I bought this black shirt. It was so fashionable at the time. You know, mind you, I'm 16 years old. And I walk into the kitchen with this black shirt on. I said, "Hey, Mom, what do you think? Johnny Potatoes, huh?" And she says, "Don't let your father see that." I say, "Why?" You know. And as I say that, he walks into the door, into the kitchen. It was a big kitchen. Well, I have no idea what happened, because all of a sudden I was around about 10, 15 feet away in the opposite corner with no shirt on, feeling bruised. And him shouting in Dutch, "I ever see you wear a black shirt in this house again, I will put you into hospital." And I've gone, "Oh, God." And I went to my mother, and he walked, stormed out, ripping the shirt to pieces. And I said to my mom, said, I was like the you know, the big baby bear and the two little mama and papa bears.
Yeah, yeah.
What I do?
Yeah.
Yeah, and she said, "Well, your father doesn't like black shirts because he didn't very much like the NSB members during the Second World War who wore black shirts."
Yeah.
And I gone, "Why didn't nobody tell me these things?"
Talking to Josh Childers, coming to the end of the interview, talking about some of his experiences growing up in Australia, becoming an Australian blues man. This track, Papaloo.
The rain came down the day you went away. Since you gone, I feel blue, yes I do. Had to change my parasol, honey, for a pair of blues. When you told me you loved me, everything was sunshine fine. But then you told me you was leaving. Oh, you said you changed your mind. Since you're gone, I feel blue, yes I do. Keep my parasol for a pair of blues. Well, I tried to keep you, baby, Lord knows how I tried. Soul was full of sunshine, now it's raining deep inside. Since you're gone, I feel blue, yes I do. Had to change my parasol for a pair of blues.
I saved up my money and bought a black and white striped one. One of those black and white striped ones. Yeah. Yeah. With a nice thin tie.
Yeah.
My peg pants and my blue suede shoes.
That's too good. So you were 14 when you came to Australia?
Yeah.
14. So you spent a lot of time in Europe.
Years.
Yeah, I know, but it's still...
That's not a lot of time in comparison.
It's not like twos.
I'm 68 this year, so that's, you know, it's a very, very small time in comparison.
You know? Yeah, but still makes you European, doesn't it? You know, people come here when they're, you know, two. They really don't remember that much.
No, but you see, I've got memories. I've got memories that go back to the age of two.
Yeah.
You know, possibly a little younger. I think I fell down the stairs when I was only one. Somehow, I see that's still in my mind. because I fell down. I remember falling down the stairs, and I think I was only about, I started walking when I was about 9 months old or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I got to the top of the stairs and said, I can do this. Instead of bumming down, I rolled down there instead.
Did your parents play any music?
No, my father didn't play any music, but he was a tenor of renown, which was, he was well known as a tenor, an amateur tenor. But, and his career got stopped by the war, of course.
Yeah.
But he traveled about a little bit as the major tenor of choirs.
Right.
Yeah, doing a lot of arias and stuff like that.
And that's where your tenor voice comes from, though.
I'm a tenor.
A tenor?
I don't think so.
Fiver or a tenor?
And my paternal grandfather was a baritone.
Yeah.
And my maternal grandfather was also a tenor.
Right.
And my mother was a soprano, and they all sang.
So that's where it comes from.
Well, so, not necessarily.
Well, when you started singing first before you started playing, didn't
well,
you?
Well, I started singing in church choir.
Yeah, I thought so. That's right. Yeah.
And I started in a church choir when I was 10. I was an alto, and I enjoyed that for 2 years. I did that, and then all of a sudden, boom, boom.
Yeah,
voice break.
It's gone. It's gone ever since.
And so by the time I was 13, I loved being in that choir, and I went to this college. And they had a boys' choir, but I was a baritone, so I asked them, could I get into the men's choir? They had a men's choir, but you had to be over the age of 14. I don't know why they do this age limitation bulldust, you know. I mean, but anyway, no, I'm not allowed to be in the men's choir, which means 14 to 20 year olds that were in the men's choir, you know. And the only way I could actually join any choir was the boys' choir. So I fooled the choir master that I was an alto, singing falsetto. and I'll tell you what, I can still see him scratching his head and saying, "He's nice alto, alto voice. But why does he talk with a voice like a bass singer?"
See, one thing I meant to ask you, MBAS, the Victorian Melbourne Blues Appreciation Society, have got you as their patron. How did that come about?
Well, it was started because of me and my band.
Yeah, the Blues Club.
Yeah, they wanted to, originally they wanted to set up a Dutch Dollars fan club. And I think it was Barry Hills and... who said to Alan Stafford, who was the first president of the MBAS, he said, "Nah, he doesn't want a bloody fan club. Why don't we start up a blues club?"
Yeah,
and then we had the organizational meeting, and Martin Cooper presided over that one, and I came up with the name Melbourne Blues Appreciation Society. I mean, you had the Canberra Blues Club, you had the New South Wales Blues Club, you had everything sort of too ordinary, you know.
Yeah.
So the Melbourne Blues Appreciation Society sounds great. You look at it, MBAS, bass, almost sounds like it's bloody African, you know. And it was accepted. And after the first meeting, as the society's first meeting, I was made life member, honorary life member.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm still number one.
That's right, yeah.
And then they decided to make me a patron, but they never asked me what to do. They didn't ask me to do anything. I mean, they never asked me to be a judge for anything. I don't think anybody cares. I don't think they care whether I exist. They just put my picture in the Blues letter every week.
It's on there every week, that's right. So, because they had B.B. King listed down there, and they got Dutch Tilders.
Well, the original patron was Bryony McGee.
Okay.
Which, again, was also my idea. They wanted to make B.B. King patron, and I said, no, who comes to Australia more often than any of the blues players?
Hmm.
Brownie McGee.
Yeah.
He was coming out here twice a year.
Yeah.
You know? I said, get Brownie. He said, well, how do you get in touch with him? I have his phone number. I remember saying to Brownie, I said, we'd like you to be patron of the Melbourne Blues Appreciation Society. He said, hell, man. He said, I ain't dead yet. And now, not patron saint, Brownie.
Wow, that's a good story, that one. Well, I really appreciate you giving me some time, Dutch. It's been great talking with you. Some great history in Australian blues there. We like those stories. And if people want to get your stuff, they get onto the web, can they? Or where do they get hold of it?
www.dutchtilders.com.au.
.au, mate.
That's right. Yeah, I love that AU thing.
We'll push them that way. We get some great material there. They should be...
a beautiful thing in Australian websites, The AU thing, you know. AU. You'll never forget that, would you?
That's right. Gives the game away, doesn't it? Well, it's a good thing. Well, I really appreciate you stepping by, and we play a lot of good stuff for the interview, and if people want to buy your material, they can get onto dutchtilders.com.au.
AU.
That's the place to be. Well, thanks, Dutch.
Thank you, Daddy.
Yeah, we've been talking with Dutch Tilders, celebrating his 50th year as the Australian blues man, 68 in 2009. A track from the direct cut, Dutch Tilders Direct. It's called Song in G to finish us off.
Salty Dog, Rhythm and Blues, Rhythm and Roots, right? Whatever.
Blues and Roots.
Roots and Rhythms.
Roots and...
Rhythms and Roots.
I like that. Okay, thanks, mate.